Okay, today is December. December 3rd. December 3rd. Okay. Everything is on one page today. I would say you need a Tanakh for the Haftorah, but I put the Haftorah on these pages, so
Can we get something?
Okay, the presentation tonight is called Chanukah in the Torah. Now that seems to be quite absurd. How could Chanukah be in the Torah? Now, Chanukah is indeed a holiday that is post-biblical. At least Purim is mentioned in the Bible, in the Book of Esther. Now, there are Gemaras that say outright, Esther min HaTorah minayin, Haman min HaTorah minayin, Mordechai min HaTorah minayin. Where are the hints to Esther, to Haman, to Mordechai? And they're not all in the same place. They're all in very different, very disparate places. There's no Gemara that says Chanukah min HaTorah minayin. But, as we'll see from these sources here, we'll see that there are quite a few very interesting elements, certainly in the Haftorah of this Shabbos. That goes without saying. But if I were to divide Chanukah into three themes, would everybody agree that I can do so as follows? One, a menorah theme. Now, menorah in itself needs some kind of explanation, because menorah is just one of a number of elements of the mikdash that was rededicated after we defeated the Greek Syrians, right? So why don't we on Chanukah eat 12 loaves of bread because the shulchan was put out of work and now we had a shulchan working again? Well, why don't we burn some incense? When the temple was defiled, there was no incense. Now we have incense again. Why? We should have meat. We should have beef and lamb and goat meat in order to rededicate ourselves to these types of sacrifices that could now once again be brought. There are lots of things we could do in order to commemorate the rededication of the temple. Mm-hmm. What is it about the menorah? Right? This question seems to be what confounded Zechariah in the Haftorah this Shabbos. But that's our first theme, the menorah. Second theme.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
So the premise of Chanukah is the rededication of the...
That's what Chanukah means. Okay. The word appears in today's Torah reading when they made a Chanukat HaMizbeach. Now, what does the word mean? It comes... The first time the word ever appears in the Torah is in Parshas Lech Lecha. Mm-hmm. When Avraham prepared an army to redeem Lot, it says, Vayorek es Chanichov. That's the word for Chanukah. Hmm. He prepared his chanichim. Same word as chinuch for education. What do all these things have in common? What's the purpose of education?
To prepare you for life.
To prepare you, to put you to use. To put you to use. Okay, your teeth that grind food are called chanichim. Chanichim. Puts your food to use. Right? So, chinuch is meant to make you useful. Got it? So, the Chanukah HaMizbeach, Chanukah HaBayis that we do. Now our house can be used. Put up mezuzahs, we put up some symbolic things in the house. Now the house can be useful. So that's the first thing, is the menorah. The second thing is that there was rampant assimilation... Right, that led to some of these problems. There was a revolt against it, but there was rampant assimilation. That is a situation that repeats itself many times in our history, right? But that's certainly an element of the story. And third is a battle where the few defeat the many. Okay? That's it. Now, these are themes that are not unique to Chanukah. What I would like to show, though, is that there are some parts of the Torah, very strategically placed and understood. Mm-hmm. Some of what I'm going to tell you, some of the hints to Chanukah are going to be fabricated. Mm-hmm. In other words, I made them up. Mm-hmm. Some are fantastically coincidental. But the Torah readings that surround Chanukah, right, is the way we read them now, which is only the Babylonian way of reading in antiquity, because they used to read the Torah every 3 years in Eretz Yisrael, right? And it's certainly neither of these are Torah laws. Nowhere in the Torah does it say to publicly read words of Torah on a regular basis. If at best the Torah tells us to read the words of Torah on the holidays, Eilu Mikrei Kodesh Asher Tikra'u Osam B'Moadam, if that's what it means. So what we are now reading, so I'm just saying it's set up the way we read the Torah now at the end of Bereishis, that there is a profoundly connected message to Chanukah in these Torah readings. And here it is. We're about to leave the friendly confines of our nuclear family. There's Avram and Yitzchak and Yaakov, right? And we have, it's relatively easy to stay with the program and stay on the derech, if you will, the way we are, right? The factor of Soloveitchik of Torah Umada of Yeshiva University claimed that this is a bigger part of the story than we think, because Yosef and his brothers, the main dispute was not just the dreams, but the content of the dreams. Mm-hmm. Why is a shepherd dreaming about astrology and about farming? Mm-hmm. He should be dreaming about 12 sheep bowing to him, or 12 shepherd's staffs bowing to his staff. Why is he dreaming about farming, which is Egyptian preoccupation, and astrology, which is certainly Egyptian preoccupation? Rather, Rav Soloveitchik molds the story to be saying the dispute is between Yosef, who feels that we need to, we're the fourth generation, we're the ones going down into the exile. We need to be prepared for that. We will be exposed to elements in that society where we need to be prepared. And the brothers said, no way, even if we are the ones to be going down, we'll be able to stay a unit, a tight unit, and we will survive in the Galus like that. And Yosef just said, you're making a big tactical mistake. And they, now this is not, of course, the Hashkacha Pratis, mm-hmm. is that they sent Yosef ahead to see, does this work? Let's see how mm-hmm. you do. Now, of course, that's Hashkacha Pratis, but the storyline is that they hated him and they wanted to get rid of him. Mm-hmm. But the Hashkacha Pratis, now later on at the end it says, V'Yosef Hayo B'Mitzrayim. You get it? Yosef Hoya, he remained as he always was in Egypt. Mm-hmm. That's where Rashi says in the beginning of Shmos, who Yosef Shinasa Melech ve Omeid Betzit Kaso. Where do you see those words in V'Yosef Yom B'Mitzrayim? Some poor Meforshim to Rashi, I think, in this particular case, say, because it doesn't say V'Tzofnas Paneach Hayo B'Mitzrayim. Nonsense. I wouldn't expect it to say V'Tzofnas Paneach Hayo B'Mitzrayim, but there should darshan the fact that it doesn't say that. Right? V'Yosef Hoya means not V'Yosef B'Mitzrayim or Im Yosef B'Mitzrayim, but V'Yosef Hoya, he remained as he always was. He serves as the paradigm. That's why when you ever hear this, when we say Yisimcha Elokim Kefraim Mechem Menashe, because Ephraim and Menashe are the first two to live in the, to be mamish, born and raised in the Gullus. And how do we know they stayed with the program? Because there's tribes of Ephraim and Menashe that stayed with the program. Gidon came from Menashe. You know, what can I say? They didn't end up always being so wonderful. Yehoshua came from Ephraim. You know, so our great leaders came from these people. So Masibonim Simon La'avos. You know, so that Ephraim and Menashe serve as that paradigm where Yosef set the stage for them to show that yes, this can be done in the Galus. So this element at the end of Sefer Bereishis of the exile. And this element of assimilation, yet, you know, it worked for Yosef. But if you hear the Medrash Vatima Leha Aretz Usam, mm-hmm. familiar the Netziv on that pasuk writes a long, long discussion and prediction about where Europe is going. He wrote this in about the year 1890, 1900. He said I think that Jewish assimilation throughout Europe is a tinderbox. And he says, "Vati maleha aretz osam," because there's a medrash that says that the Jews could be found everywhere in Egypt. Where? Especially in the theaters and the circuses. And their theaters and circuses were places of terrible shvichus damim, terrible, terrible things. But probably the Medrash was thinking of the Roman theaters and circuses and gladiators and you know, what they were doing when they were writing things like this. It was a critique about the Jews, the assimilated Jews in Rome, who were making their ways into all these places. And the Tziv predicts that we're doing it again in Europe, and I don't see it going into a good place. So on the pasuk Vatim Aleha Aretz Osam, you know what I'm talking about, the beginning of Shmos, right? Bnei Israel Paro Beyishu Tzuve Yubu Beyatzmu Bemod Meod Vatim Aleha Aretz Osam. You were supposed to stay in Goshen, right? So instead you went Vatim Aleha Aretz Osam. So that's the element of assimilation. But I submit to you that there is also this amazing element at the end of Sefer Bereishis of another part of the Chanukah story, and it reaches its culmination in this week's parsha. Miketz always coincides with Chanukah. I say about 4 or 5 times a century, Chanukah misses Miketz. Mm-hmm. But this is the part of my fabrication, because the Torah wasn't always read this way. Mm-hmm. For the last 2,000 years, it has been okay. Right after the Chanukah story happened, we start to read the Torah this way. Right? We have some of these makoros, some extra ones here.
Oh, where is there?
Okay. I made 30, so they should be there. Okay, so...
Can you pass them down?
So,
we need them in there.
So what happens at the end of Bereishis is that at the end of a number of stories where a younger brother is constantly outperforming the older sibling... It's almost the rule in Sefer Bereishis. But in our story, Paro, again, the question of that we usually dream what we're preoccupied with. A shepherd shouldn't be dreaming of farming and astrology. But what does Paro dream about? Yes,
I have a question. But could it be that maybe that was a precursor of prophecy? I mean, he was a prophet. But dreams, because right now, don't we say that the only...
Definitely, the Torah last week considers Yosef to be Mamash Anavi, because it says, Hashem diber mi lo yinoveh. When you think that God is giving you a message, you've got to share that message. That's why he could, I spoke about that this past Shabbos at the Hashkamashir, if any of you were there, but Yosef had to tell his dreams. It seems to be immature of a 17-year-old. You should know better. Don't share these dreams. He had to. He considered them to be prophetic in nature. And the prophecy was not so much of you bowing to me, but that we need to prepare ourselves for the Egyptian experience. See, everyone is so preoccupied, the Mefarshim and all the readers of the Yosef story, with something bowing down to him. That's not the main focus of the dream. The main focus is what's bowing down. And that's really, in other words, you bowing to me is, you will one day admit to me that I was right about this cheshbon, that we need to prepare ourselves for our time in the exile. Right? Because if we're not properly prepared, if you think that you can keep yourselves in a box, remember, who in Sefer Bereishis is in a box?
Sarah.
Dina's in a box. Why? Because when it says Yaakov introduced his family to Esav, it says he only introduced the boys. Wait a second, there's a girl in the family. Why didn't you introduce Dina? So Rashi says that Yaakov had her hidden away lest she be overcome by the wiles of Esav. Esav put his eyes on her. So Rashi, ever the Baal Musar and the ironist, Rashi says, you know, Yaakov, you could have given your daughter, because marrying a niece was very popular at this time. Marrying your brother's daughter was very common. So you could have given your daughter Dina to someone who was at least circumcised. Chayecha, she will be taken by someone who is not circumcised. Shechem. But that's just the point, is that homiletically we understand the beginning of that story about Tetzei Dina to mean...
coming out of the box.
Right. And she was not prepared for what's out there. I'm not saying we have to take our kids and, you know what I'm saying, and expose them to every narishkeit that's out there to be. But if we think we can inoculate them from some of the, you know, let's say Sheva Chochmas or something like that, and just once they're exposed to it, there's trouble. Right? Okay, so let's so these are the three, but it, so when Paro dreams about something that ought not to be the preoccupation of an absolute monarch, which is something gaunt and thin and right, something wind blown that should fall away. And what does it do? It overcomes and overpowers something that's much stronger than it and much bigger than it. You know, the two dreams of power, right? Mm-hmm. I know how Rashi doesn't catch it, but the Rashi says the two dreams are just to show how serious this is. It's about to happen. Yosef tells him why the two dreams. He says, because there are 7 years asher ein chorish v'kotzir. You get it? The chorish are the seven cows. Cows plowed then. The kotzir are the seven shibolim. So the two dreams because of the two predictions. So Paro is confounded. Where in my, possibly in my experience, is there any room for me to have rapid eye movement that interprets brain waves that talk about something weak defeating the strong? That's not me. That's not anything in Paro's head. You can only dream about what's in your consciousness. You could dream that you're talking French, but you're not really talking French. Unless you actually talk French. Right? So that confounds Paro, and none of his magicians can explain it, because they're afraid to say that that's in his consciousness. They'd rather say you're going to have seven daughters and you're going to bury them, because that's possible. That has happened in Egypt. But no, it doesn't happen that the weak overcome the strong. No such thing. But it's Yosef who has to tell him an important message. Is that right now, let's fabricate some numbers. Right now, Egypt produces a unit of five of produce. For the next 7 years, you're producing seven. That's amazing.
That what?
You're going to have a 40% jump in what you produce. Uh-huh. Right? You're going to produce seven. 7 years are plenty, right? I'm making up numbers. Right?
Oh, okay.
But for 7 years after that, you're producing two. Do you get what the point is?
Yes.
When those thin cows eat the fat ones, they don't get fatter themselves. In other words, I have to convince you, Paro, something a Paro is never going to think to do, that during the years of plenty, can you figure out what Yosef is really telling him? You have to live with less than what you're used to. That's like Sefer Mishlei. That's a big musa. You know what I'm saying? That when you, who thinks of saving when you have so much? Well, I'll save a little bit though, maybe a little, right? There's never going to be a rainy day, right? So I'm telling you, the rainy day is coming. But here's what it is: the rainy day is going to cancel out. So Paro, no one can even think of telling this to Paro. Okay, so that's the element of the Hanukkah story that says the few defeating the many. Okay, so let's look. So now I'm going to, in my I made up a lot of these, but there's just some just amazing coincidences in the Torah. So when it comes to Hanukkah, we're going to concentrate on the number 25, right?
Okay.
The number 250 is the gematria of Ner, right? Mm-hmm. Right. 8 is going to be pretty big. Mm-hmm. Okay. The word Yad, right? Rabim biyad ma'atim. Tmeim biyad tohrim. How many do we say in Al Anisim? If you look on the back page, you'll see it at the top. You see it, it says, Giborim biyad chalashim. Rabim biyad ma'atim. Look at the back side on the left. Tmeim biyad tohrim. Rishaim biyad tzadikim. Yedim biyad oskei torasecha. Right? So that's five hands. How does that connect to Hanukkah?
25.
Five hands have 25 fingers on them. Okay, now when in the Torah reading, when they speak about how Yosef put food before the brothers, but he put a lot more before Binyamin. Look what it says inside. You see, right above those biyads. Get it.
Kulam
chamesh yados vayishtu vayishikru imo. He put five hands in front of Binyamin. So that's... Plus, in Paro's dream, do you know that the word Yad appears five times?
No.
So these are all just, you know, obvious coincidences, but five hands, all right? All these things hint at the number 25.
What was the thing you said about 5 years and 2 years?
No, I made those up just to say that you produce more in the plenty years of plenty, but the years of famine are going to not only cancel that, but they're going to make it worse. You're not going to average five.
Right.
So it's unheard of to convince someone during the years of plenty, okay, I'll save one. I'll eat six and I'll save one. Right?
Right.
No, you've got to eat four this year.
Right.
You eat less. That's a Hebrew, that's a Musser. That's a Sefer Mishlei. That's, Paro doesn't live like that.
Right.
Okay. All right, so now, again, I'm going to bring proof from Ma'oz Tzur, but you remember at the end of Ma'oz Tzur, it says the first line, Le'eis tochin matbeach mitzor hamenabeach. The Hebrew is just amazing. It's prophetic, this poem. What does it mean, Le'eis tochin matbeach? Now, to prepare a slaughter, that's really what it is. But those exact words actually do appear in Sefer Yeshayahu, that God prepared a slaughter. But look at Parshas Miketz, where Yosef prepares food for his brothers. You see where it says, I underlined it towards the right side at the top. I should have put numbers here. See, I wrote, Le'ez tochin matbeach mitzor haminabeach. You see that? Nabeach means from the enemy that roars. So when Yosef put out food for them, it says, Utvoach tevach, which means he put out slaughtered meat. Utvoach tevach vehochein.
Right? He prepared.
And prepared. So you see the word utvoach tevach, meaning you slaughtered a slaughter, right? But if you take, you see them from the ches, you see the next four letters, vehochein.
Uh-huh.
Right? Yeah. What do those five letters spell?
Chanukah.
The word Chanukah is in there.
but if you have to change the order.
Yeah, of course. But the person who wrote Le'eis Tochin Matbeach. Hear the words. Tavach Tavach Behochin. Tochin Matbeach. Okay, all right, anyway. So just a hint to something is at the end of Parshas Miketz, the Torah does something that it never does elsewhere. I'll explain what I mean. It's not the Torah, actually, but it's... So we don't know even the person who did this, but at the end of each Torah laning, there is a word or words that encompass the gematria of the amount of psukim in that parasha. Every parasha, remember, which is the only one that's the last word in that Torah reading? Right. Vayetze ends with the word machanayim, and that's Vayetze's word. Right? That's how many psukim are in Vayetze, the gematria melachim. Miketz is the only one that does the following. You see, I wrote Kuf Mem Vav Psukim. It's a big parasha, 146 Psukim. It's the Gematria of Yechizki Yahu Simon, Amatzia Simon, Yud Yihyeh Li Eved Simon. The Tevos Alpayim Chafei. And there are 2,025 words in Parshas Miketz. It's the only one that does this. No other parasha tells you how many words are in the parasha. So you see 2,025 words. So you see what I wrote underneath? Ner is gematria 250 times 8 is 2,000 plus 25 for the day of the month. So I think that's why it did this. We don't know who did it. We don't know who wrote these notes at the end. But that seems to be what it is.
It's also the number 25. So it's 25
hands. 2025. Yeah. The 25th word of the Torah. Let's look at it. Now turn back to the front page. The 25th word of the Torah is, you want to count them? Is it trust?
Or?
Yeah, it's or. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Light is the 25th word of the Torah.
Right.
It gets even better at the bottom, but I can't believe I put it in the machine and it cut it off. It gave you too much space at the top, and it cut off the exact last line, which is that the 25th journey we took in the desert was a place called Chashmona. And the word is chet, eight, shmona. All these eights, why does Hanukkah have to last 8 days? Why didn't the oil last 4 days or 12 days or 17 days? What is it about 8 days?
Bris Mila.
So Bris Mila is maybe that's just asking the same question. Why is Bris Mila on the 8th day and not on the 12th day or the 4th day? So we say, okay, 7 is a circular, cyclical number. It's a teva, it's a natural number. 8 is lamalim in a teva. 8 goes right beyond natural, supernatural. Could be. If you want to Google vitamin K, you know what vitamin K does? It helps to clot blood. Vitamin K is practically non-existent when we're born. And it very quickly comes into the baby on its first day. They heal to make sure, right? But it starts to kick in very quickly. And it rises, it spikes. It keeps rising and rising. You got to look this up because you wouldn't believe it. And you're at the highest level of vitamin K in a human being is when that human is 8 days old, and then it goes way down. Whoa, sorry.
That's okay. Yeah.
And then it levels off for the rest of the day. Hemophiliac just stays down, and it goes to lower and lower and lower, and it never spikes. It doesn't go anywhere. But you have to see this. It's crazy. So Hashem knew the 8th day is the best time to make. For clotting,
to help out.
Okay, so for korban also for okay, so but that's not my purpose here. The 8th day that Hanukkah had to last for 8 days is exactly perfect for the simple reason: if the temple fell out of use, there's one thing in temple times that's really proliferating in Israel is tumas mace, the tumah of dead bodies. Everyone dies. There's death all the time. Everyone in this room went to a funeral this year, right? Something or one or more, right? So we're facing death all the time.
And also they're fighting.
And they just had a battle, right? So there's lots of death defilement. All right, but there's been death defilement for a good long time, right? And it takes 7 days after a purification process to now get whatever new things I need that are pure. Now, right across the street from the temple is this big mountain that's called Mount of Olives. So there was plenty of olive oil to take, but there are two answers to that question. One is that the Greeks destroyed all of them. They engaged in terrible scorched earth around Jerusalem. But two, even if it was there, you couldn't touch the grapes for 7 days. If now the temple is in our hands, we can now do what you know we have to do for now. All of this, if you really want to get lumdus, is tumah hutra b'tzibur. Tumah hutra b'tzibur means that there is no such thing as tumah in public. You know what I'm saying, if everyone is tame, just work in the Beis Hamikdash. There's this sort of a kufaray. Remember in Melbourne, there's a tzitz. Do a sex machina in the Beis Hamikdash that clears up. Okay, no tumah. Right. So why didn't they rely on that? So the answer is, they always use this drasha in school dinners. When it comes to chinuch, you don't cut corners. You don't look for Chanukah semizbech. You don't look for an easy way out. You do it, the way it's supposed to be and shine. Okay. Now all of this has been like nasharai. But there's a very serious perush of Rav Sadia Gaon that's at the top of this page, where he says that there's a very serious. I mean, this is not just everything now has been like Shalosh Shudas Torah, right? But this is a very serious perush of Rav Sadia Gaon, claiming that the Hanukkah story is hinted in the blessing of Levi in Vezosa Bracha. Now, if the Gemara said Purim min haTorah minayin, why do you think? Why would the Gemara say? I want to know, where is there Esther in the Torah? Where is Haman in the Torah? Where is Mordechai in the Torah? Why are they engaging in such a thing? Because the canonicity of the Purim story was in question. Mm. Right? So in order to respond to those, think of, if you know the Gemara in Megillat Daf Zayin, where Esther had to go up to all the rabbis and say, Kisvuni the Doros, Kivuni the Doros. They didn't want to canonize the story. What's so special about this story, right? And she went and convinced everybody it's because of Esther. That's why the story is called Megillat Esther, because she convinced them that this story deserves a second looking, and let's learn it. So the Hanukkah should be, it's worse off. It's not even in the Bible at all. So for the sake of those who were not observing it, you should know that the people who left us the Dead Sea Scrolls despised the Cheshmonaim. They despised Hanukkah. Well, they also don't mention Purim. The Book of Esther is not yet to be found in any Dead Sea Scrolls text. They did not go hold from Hanukkah and Purim. Certainly not Hanukkah. They went to the Dead Sea to escape the Hanukkah story, to escape the people who were involved. Well, by the time they were writing that, which is not so much after, the Cheshmonaim turned pretty bad.
Yeah.
They didn't stay good for long. In fact, the Chasam Sofer has a tshuva that the reason why Hanukkah was taken out of the Mishnah, there is no Mishnah on Hanukkah, there's a Masechta on Purim. The Mishnah makes reference, passing reference to Hanukkah on some passing issues that connect to Hanukkah, but not because of Hanukkah. There's no Mishnah that tells us how to light the menorah. It's a Gemara, it's a Braisa, right? So Rabbi Yehuda Nasi was from the line of King David, right? So the Chasam Sofer makes the bold statement that Rabbi purposely kept Hanukkah out of the Mishnah because he didn't like the origins. What are these Kohanim ruling instead of my family?
So why did it survive the halachic day? How did it survive then?
So that's the Gemara asks this question when it says my Hanukkah, which the Chasam Sofer takes to mean, what's so special about Hanukkah? It's in Megillas Tainis, right? And it's in Megillas Tainis like 100 other holidays. We got rid of all those holidays. Why do we hold on to Hanukkah? So the Gemara answers, there's a miracle, a miraculous aspect to it. They were all Hashem Shemayim. All right, so it turned bad afterwards, but it deserves a perpetuation. But let's see what Sadia Gaon's point is. It says, Ululevi Omar, Tumecha Ve'urecha Le'ish Chasidecha. Okay, this is not what Sadia Gaon says, but Urecha gives a hint to Or. Tumecha gives a hint to like Urim V'tumim, something about the Beis HaMikdash. But okay, but that's natural. Levi are the ones working there. Mm-hmm. By the time this is written, the Bechorim are no longer in the temple. It's Levi, right? So if there's something about a temple restoration, I should expect the tribe of Levi, which some of whom are Kohanim, to be involved. Okay? Asher nisiso b'masa tirivehu almei meriva. Okay, I'm just trying to be as simple as possible before his actual proof comes in, is that there's a pasuk like this in Sefer Hosea, Kimrivei Kohen. Has anyone ever heard of this? That Kohanim are like hot blooded. You ever hear this?
Yeah, uh-huh.
You've heard this before, right?
Nice. Yeah.
Where does it come from? Because of all the meat they ate, probably. Yeah. I don't know. They were big meat eaters. These were carnivores, and they had to eat the meat, like Pinchas. Yeah, right. If one of us Yisraelim, if we don't get an aliyah, if we get an aliyah every 3 months, wow, I got an aliyah. You know, a Kohen goes a week without an aliyah, he's getting crazy, you know. Right? So HaOmer, so Moshe is trying to say that Levi should channel that kind of anger and aggressiveness and aggression into a good place. Don't forget, the original Levi, you know what he did with Shimon. Now Shimon, so Yaakov curses them somewhat when he says Achal kein bi Yaakov afitzein bi Israel. So Rashi says he wants to separate the two of them from the other. I don't want these two together. They should never live near one another. However, I think what the simple pshat is Achal kein bi Yaakov afitzein bi Israel is that they never really inherited their own identifiable land in Israel. Mm-hmm. You know, Shimon does not have look in Sefer Yehoshua. It says Shimon was assimilated into the land of Yehuda. Mm-hmm. They're in the south. So really, if you say they're 10 lost tribes, they're really 9 lost tribes, because Shimon was part of Yehuda as much as Binyamin was. Right? So it's an interesting thing. But be it as it may, Shimon went his way. Levi, of course, didn't receive land himself because he's all over Israel. So continue. HaOmer lo aviv limo lo reisiv v'sechov lo ikir v'espanov lo yadak yishmuri mosechov rischa yintzoru. Okay, I'm skipping this because it's not part of Sadia Gaon's point, but this, according to Rashi, is a reference to the Egel story. Mm-hmm. And it says, Yoru mishpatecha li Yaakov v'sarascha li Yisrael. it says you're going to be the teachers, right? Right? Kechol asher yeruaschem hakohanim halaviyim tishmeru lasos, right? Yosimu ketarabah pecha v'chalil al mizbechacha. He's going to be the one to put the incense on the mizbeach, and he's going to be the one to put the animals on the mizbeach. Okay, here is the pasuk. Ready? Barech Hashem chelo. May God bless the army of Shevet Levi. Upoal yadav tirtzeh, and may whatever he puts his hands to be successful. Mechatz masnayim kamav, umisanav min yikumun. May he smite the masnayim. Maze masnayim means like the trunk.
The loins.
The trunk, the loins of the enemy. Umisanav min yikumun, and may he smite the ones who hate him, so that they can no longer rise up. The note here, the bottom note, number 5, talks about, you see, that this is a pasuk zeh nevuah. You see line number 2? Pasuk zeh nevuah al nitzachon b'nei chashmonoi hakohanim shehim mizera levi al hayivonim. So the Targum actually explains masnayim to refer to yivonim. But this fails to get the real point across. Is that, you remember in the book of Daniel, when Nebuchadnezzar has a dream of a giant figure, where everything from the feet keep getting more and more and more dear and more, like the head is gold, the shoulders are silver, the midsection is bronze, and it keeps going down and down, right? So the midsection in Daniel's interpretation is Greece, because the head is Bavel. The shoulders is what is going to conquer you. The reason why Nebuchadnezzar didn't kill Daniel for rendering such an interpretation, which was not really so positive, is because there was an element to Daniel interpreting Nebuchadnezzar's dream, which was different than Yosef's, which is...
Nebuchadnezzar, well, what I remember is that Nebuchadnezzar wanted him to tell him the entire dream and the interpretation.
Right. Nebuchadnezzar didn't know the dream even. Rashi says this because by Nebuchadnezzar it says Vatit Pa'em Rucho, and by Yeparo it just says Vatit Pa'em Rucho. One tough for you. Right. Anyway, but that's trash. But so one is that Nebuchadnezzar didn't even remember the dream, and he said, I'm killing all of the magicians unless one of you tells me the dream, and don't fabricate one, because I'll know if it wasn't the dream. Right? See, you know, this is such a typical story of anti-Semitism. You'd think all the other magicians would be thankful for Daniel for coming up with at least a satisfactory dream,
right,
if not a satisfactory interpretation, right? But no, they hated him more, right? And there's no indication that he gloated over it, the way Yosef did, but they're right. Even when the Jew is doing something that makes it positive for the other, they still hate it. It's irrational. It's the rationality of anti-Semitism. So Daniel tells him the dream, and he brightens up. He says, "Yes, yes, yes. That's exactly it." Right. So Daniel tells him, "You are the head. You are the greatest king, most powerful king the world has yet seen to this day." And he bothers him up, and he says, "And then he says, but the shoulders are going to grow out." And the silver will defeat the gold. Those are the Persians. And the Masnayim, he says, he names Yevanim. He says, are the ones that will defeat the Persians. And the Masnayim will be defeated by others. And they will be defeated by others. And that's the way the world goes.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're talking about the blessing the tribe of Levi with an ability to smite the midsection, so Sadia goes and says, "Hey, that's the Chanukah story. An army made up of Kohanim that smites the Masnayim." There you have it.
Where is this from?
That's the Bracha of Levi and Vizosa Bracha. I should put that down there. It's Vizosa Bracha. Okay, I think now we're ready for Zechariah. But of course, we're not going to be able to finish it today. This next Monday is just ending Hanukkah. So if you don't mind, I'm going to milk 2 shiurim out of this. So the Hanukkah will be over at Mincha on Monday afternoon. So we'll see. Okay, so turn to the back of these pages, and this is this week's Haftorah.
Isru Chag,
what? Isru Chag, good. Yeah. Just keep Yom Tov Hanukkah Sheni Shogoli. Yes, yes.
What you were saying earlier about Pharaoh and...
Can you pass me that Tanakh?
Less, maybe because at that time... The Egypt would have to live less because they were going to be the ones who would feed the other nations. It wasn't.
Not only that, that's for sure, because you're going to make a. You're going to make
more
a.
More for the others.
Not only that. Yes, but you're going to make a lot of money on this.
Oh, yeah.
Right? This might be why the Egyptians started to hate the Jews, because they. Although Rashi says that Yosef told the populace, save food. Did Paro share this insider information with everybody? This is an amazing stock tip. Right?
The populace became his slaves.
Right, he actually became, but it looked like Yosef despoiled them. Uh-huh. Get it?
So it wasn't Yosef's intention to do it.
Sure, look. Rashi says that Yosef shared the information with everybody. It's just that for them it's spoiled. They didn't have maybe the storage facilities that Paro had, I don't know. But, you know, grain can store for a long time, especially flour can store.
And maybe also you say it's put two people to the cities, so maybe it's making it closer to the collect together, so it's much easier to distribution. But all of this, although it's interpreted like a bad stuff, because you took it from one place and then moved to the other place.
If you look at the anti-Semitic screeds of Richard Wagner, it's really a lot of the same things. Taking the rustic, the Jew urbanizes us, and the Jew forces us into places where we'd rather not live. And then, okay. While we're sitting here, I thought of another. You know, we're reading Parshas Naso now, right? Which is about the Chanukah Samizbeach, and it goes right into Baloscha, the menorah. Isn't that amazing?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Right, so and there are 89 psukim in Parshas Naso, that parsha, which is the largest parak in the entire Bible. This is another example, pure fabrication. 89 is the gematria of Chanukah. All the psukim that are in the laning that we're making this whole week, right. Is 89 psukim. Right. That's less than nonsense, this statement, because this whole system of how to break up the text into chapters is a Christian fabrication of the Middle Ages.
Right.
Yes.
Rabbi, the people knew that Joseph saved them because they thanked him for saving their lives.
Yes, but when two generations later someone wants to forget Yosef and find a reason, well, why do we hate Yosef? Do you know what he did?
Right.
Do you know? So that happens all the time.
Right.
Where the certain contribution is fabricated, but and then it just becomes a fact. But yes, the people in Yosef's own day were probably indebted to him and understood that. But there's no question that Paro is sort of using Yosef in a way to take full control of his land, mm-hmm. based on his insider information. Okay, all right. So you'll see in the Haftorah for this that we'll read the Shabbos that all three elements that I mentioned to start this year, all three elements we have to share with you of the few. Defeating the many, the rampant assimilation, as well as the menorah. The menorah is the main focus. Maybe next week I'll show you some pictures of the way some artists have depicted this vision of Zechariah. This is the fourth of 13 visions that appear in the beginning of Sefer Zechariah, the first six chapters of Zechariah. And I must tell you, each one is more bizarre than the other. There are clear indications within the story, as difficult as it is for us to understand, that Zechariah himself didn't really understand all these visions. How do I know? Because in some of them, the God tells Zechariah, what do you see? And he says, God, for the life of me, I can't describe what I see. So God sends him an angel and says, this is what you see. Now go tell the people what it means. And he says, I don't understand what this means. Right? So, and then the angel explains to him, this is what it means. Now go share it with the people. Right? So this is Radak in his introduction to Zechariah says this. Rashi opens up his commentary to Zechariah by saying, the prophecies of Zechariah are very, he calls them stumim, they're closed, they're very hidden to us. I will do my best in interpreting them from the Targum of Yonasan ben Uziel, right? Which is the Targum, you know, Navi's Targum Onkelos. So the first vision of Zechariah is of three horses chasing another horse. The last vision has a similar element to it. So Abravanel, whose thesis, and it's certainly it seems to be a correct thesis, his thesis is that these 13 visions are 13 major historical events between the time of Zechariah and what Abravanel claims would be the Messianic era. And the 13th is for our time. Abravanel used this in retrospect quite unsuccessfully to prove that the events leading up to the Spanish expulsion from Spain, which had been brewing for over 100 years with the Inquisition, that these events were a harbinger to the Messianic era. He writes this explicitly in his commentary to Daniel. The commentary is known as Mimayene HaYeshua, where Abravanel writes about the rampant faithlessness of the Spanish Jew in the face of such suffering. And he says they have all lost hope in Mashiach, and I will revive that hope with this commentary to Daniel. In his commentary to Zechariah, he claims that the first vision of the three horses are the three kingdoms left behind by Alexander the Great. The second case of three horses, which he claims spans from Alexander to 1492, what would be something of three that would be significant at that time? Abravanel wouldn't write that.
What was the first one? Three?
The three kingdoms that Alexander the Great left.
Yes. Macedonia, Syria, and Egypt.
He claims it's the three ships that are sailing to the New World that Abravanel said would lead us. I don't know how quickly, but will lead the world to a more enlightened place.
Really?
That's different than the despicable existence we have in Europe.
Wow.
And he's thought that the three ships represent these three horses, and that life will get better for us as a result of these three ships.
Wow.
He does not betray any sentiment about... He probably knew Columbus. Bravanel is the Jew in the famous painting with Torquemada and Ferdinand and Isabella. The Jew who was offered the right to stay, but he refused.
He
left
it
with everybody else. And purportedly, Columbus had quite a few Jews on his ship.
Yes,
there's even some suggestion that he himself had some Jewish background, I'm not sure if we want Columbus.
Right.
It's also very tenuous.
Yeah, but okay, you've read all the theories and all the, you know. Okay, he did push off leaving to the day after Tisha B'Av, right?
Yeah.
So, be that as it may, so these three ships, he thinks represents the last of the 13 visions. The Hanukkah story is the fourth. Right, so you should see what he does with all the intermediary. He says Christianity is there, Rome is there, the barbarians are there. He says it's all there, right? And the main message for the Jew is actually towards the bottom of the page. No, I gave you the Rashi with Vayirak is Chanichav. On the last. The bottom of the page on the left side. I haven't done the Haftorah yet, but this is one of his later visions, where Abravanel explains it about weights and measures. The weights and measures are flying in the air, and they're being carried on wings, and they're floating all over the world. Again, these are very esoteric prophecies, and like I said, Zechariah himself doesn't understand them. Rashi explains this prophecy as an opportunity for the Jewish people. Because when I gave you the Torah, I expected you to observe it, no doubt, but to use it to make the world a better place. That does not necessarily mean that your mission is to be missionaries. You can ask, if we're so sure that our Torah is the perfect thing, the best thing for man, why did we never missionize the way Christians did? They go to all four corners of the world and go under great duress. This guy just killed, trying to missionize on an Indian island. Why have we never do that? So the answer is, you ever thought, yes?
Because it's the opposite. If Jews live the Torah, then the world will be attracted and come to them.
Okay, that's one thing. That's a good solution. Or because we don't believe that everybody needs to keep Shabbos. We believe that everybody needs to keep seven mitzvot b'nei Noach. Right? And it's not because I feel exclusive. Right? We were never proselytizing. Now you can say, yeah, good Shabbos. Of course you couldn't. If you did, they would kill you. So even when we had the power to proselytize, we didn't. We didn't. The Gemara says very clearly during the days of David and Shlomo, when we certainly had the power to proselytize and we had the wherewithal, and the people who wanted to, we didn't accept, at least not readily, because it has to be from the heart, it has to be true, it has to be because of something I find inherently good and wholesome in this type of lifestyle. So if it's something that will be a blessing to you, especially since Judaism feels that you don't have to be Jewish to have salvation. Mm-hmm. What I mean by that is, a soul that is saved, so to say, and go on to the next world and live a saved state, so to say. So what Zechariah Hay is saying in this question about the flying weights, mm-hmm. is that Rashi says that when you got the Torah, the people that you would be exposed to were Philistine in nature. And I mean that with a small p, but it could be with a large, uppercase P as well. In other words, the people you would be exposed to were not, they were not interested. They were not good vessels for your message. The Ammonite, the Moabite, the Aramean, their idolatrous ways precluded any hope of spreading the Abrahamic code of chesed and mishpat and tzedakah. It was not to be heard. But now it's different. The world is going to love wisdom. You're going to be talking to people like Aristotle and Socrates. These people are highly intellectual. And what you need to show them is a moral streak. Of all things, he says, be just with your weights. Be just in the marketplace. Let them see a Kiddush Hashem and they'll want to come along. Because you have a Torah that's way beyond what anyone else has. That's why Talmi ordered the translation of the Torah into Greek. Mm-hmm. They're ready to hear it. And for whatever, he just bemoans the fact that we did not influence them as much as they Hellenized us. Which leads us into the Hanukkah story, which is next week, the Haftorah will do in Mitzvah Hashem. Here, the middle of the page. That's really what we're going to do. That's all we have left. And I left the best for last. So that's what we're going to do next week. Okay? Pay close attention during the laning on Shabbos. All right? Please pass these pages up because we'll use it again next week. Thank you all for coming. Marav is next door.
I wrote it.
Oh, no, keep it. No, you should. Sure. Bring it back next week.
Okay.
Okay, excellent. Okay. Leon, there's no Gemara Shir today.
What?
There's no Gemara Shir today. We're just doing this for
half.
Thanks so much for coming.
You want to go back now?
Yes.
I don't think you need to come in. What were the three things?